Am I on? You hear me? Okay, good. Sometimes you can't tell from up here. There are many lessons to be learned from the fifth chapter of Nehemiah that can be helpful to us as we live out our lives in faithfulness to God and in His plan for us. There are lots of lessons to be learned in the book of Nehemiah. And Christy showed me a copy of the map. You know the map that's in the book of the wall and where Nehemiah walked around it? She took the time to copy it and then put in the names of all the people who built the different portions around the wall. Different colors. I'm not sure what the different colors are for, but I'm sure she could tell me. So there's lots of things you can do to get to know and understand and see what Nehemiah is about. But there are so many lessons for us to learn. We have had various people, of course, speaking at different times, and I encouraged you last time I was here to fill up more of the front for when the next speaker came, and I would encourage you to do that for Mark next week and for the others who follow. You know, this lesson in the connection study, the guide is called Nehemiah Promotes the Welfare of the Poor, and the NIV caption says, Nehemiah helps the poor. And these give us a general idea of what is happening in this chapter. But the underlying it all is God's plan for social equity in Israel. Underlying it all is God's plan for social equity in Israel. He had given them the laws, the rules that he wanted them to live by socially. And this is what is at work here and what is the problem or the solution to it. This plan and the outworkings of the plan are pinned on the faithfulness of God to his people. His laws, whether they're the sacrificial laws, the moral laws, the dietary laws, or the social community laws, all of these laws are given to us always for our benefit. They are there as evidence of his care for us and his provision for our welfare. I suppose that that's another way of simply saying his laws are evidence of his grace towards us. You know, his laws aren't there to put us down. They're not there to make us feel bad. They're not there to be, you know, a big angry God. You know, the laws are there for our good, for our benefit, to set us free to be living like the children of God that we are supposed to be. Always. There are no exceptions. The laws are there for our benefit. And when we moan and groan under the laws, we misunderstand what the laws are all about. Everything was going well. The people were gung-ho to build the wall of Jerusalem. Well, almost everyone. There were a few hoity-toity elite from Tekoa that weren't really ready to get involved. But everybody else, they were involved constructing the wall. And so apart from these few, the people in Jerusalem were united in building the wall. People from all walks of life, shoulder to shoulder. Perfumers and goldsmiths and priests and nobles and humble people of all walks of life, shoulder to shoulder, working together. Great stuff. But as they worked together, shoulder to shoulder, a serious problem raises its head, its ugly head. Perhaps it's sort of because of the closeness of everybody working together. You know, that the things that were seething with inside them, the resentments that they had, which they weren't talking about, broke out in this, this pean of complaint that they brought to Nehemiah. Everybody knew that things were not going well for a lot of people in the city. But now it can no longer go on. It can't just continue being hidden. Some of the workers on the wall are being impoverished and held hostage in a financial fix by people that are working right alongside them. The explosion seems to catch Nehemiah, the newcomer, the leader, by surprise. This is sometime within the first 52 days, because it's not partway through six that they get to the 52 days of completing the wall. So sometime in the first 7 weeks or so, this happens. I said, read it, Nehemiah 5, 1 to 5. Now, the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. Some were saying, we and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain. Others were saying, we are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get grain during the famine. Still others were saying, we have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Although we are all of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we've had to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. In light of the huge task of building the wall and the enemies of Judah surrounding them, chapter 4 closes with the plans to keep everybody safe and to keep the wall being built. There's people who are going to hold on to the weapons, and there are people who are going to do the work. And there's a message, we're widely scattered, so if you hear the trumpet blow from here, everybody come, because we're being threatened under attack. But we're still going to get the job done. And this calm, unity, and purpose is shattered by the hue and cry of a few people, of some of the men and their wives. There were three interrelated problems that they gave you here. Some people had large families, and they had to get a lot of grain, and they didn't have the wherewithal to get it. Others said they'd had to mortgage their lands to eat during the famine. Now you say, well, where's the famine? Well, they're surrounded by enemies. The farmers can't get out to their land, for one thing. And the merchants there, they're all busy working on the wall. They're not carrying out their business, apparently. But others are saying, you know what? We are just like our neighbors. We are the chosen people of God. We are brothers and sisters. We are the people of Israel. And our sons are just as good as the oppressor's sons, you know? But we are being forced to consider selling our sons into slavery. Some of our daughters we've already sold into slavery. And this isn't fair. Well, life often isn't fair. But that's their complaint. We deserve better from our brothers who are oppressing us. And again, I say, it seems like Nehemiah, who obviously knew there were problems, maybe didn't understand extent of it until he got this complaint. He knew there were problems, as we'll find out later, because he was already loaning money to people. Last week, Pastor John repeated several times chapter 4, verse 14, do not be afraid of them. I think he, almost every time he quoted that, he also added, and do not give up. But anyway, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome. That's good news. And fight for your brothers, your sons, and your daughters, your wives and your homes. You know what? Every time John said that last week, it was like, and don't give up, Nehemiah. It's not time to give up. But I wonder if this challenge by Nehemiah to fight for their lands, to fight for their wives, to fight for their children, helped provoke the complaint. They're here and they're saying, yeah, that's all well and good, Nehemiah, but we are fighting for our homes and our children, but we cannot continue to do that under the present circumstances. And so they sort of blow Nehemiah out of the water with this complaint that they have. And it's not just a few people. There's a lot of them. You know, somebody said God must love poor people because he made a whole bunch of them. And that just seems to be the way when you have society. You have those who are better off and a great many who are not so great off. That's a good way of putting that, isn't it? Well, the Expositor's Bible Commentary sort of captures this whole idea when it says, we open the fifth chapter of Nehemiah with a shock of pain. The previous chapter described a scene of patriotic devotion in which nearly all the people were united for the prosecution of one great purpose. There we saw the priest and the wealthy citizens side by side with their humble brethren, engaged in the common task of building the walls of Jerusalem and guarding the city against assault. The hardiness with which the work was first undertaken, the readiness of all classes to resume it after temporary discouragement, and the martial spirit shown by the whole population, standing under arms and prosecuting, determined to resist any interference from without. These were all signs of a large-minded zeal in which we would have expected private interest to have given place to the public necessities of the hour. But now we're compelled to look at the seamy side of city life. In the midst of unavoidable toils and dangers occasioned by the animosity of the Samaritans, miserable internal troubles had broken out among the Jews, and the perplexing problems which seemed to be inseparable from gathering people together in large numbers under any social system known in the past or in the present have developed in the most acute form. The gulf between the rich and the poor had widened ominously. For while the poor had been driven to the last extremity, their more fortunate fellow citizens had taken a monstrously cruel advantage of their helplessness. You know, sometimes you read what somebody else said and you think, well, that's better said than I can say it. But it's just a picture of what was going on. And so we can see clearly that this had to be attended to, or there would probably be a great problem in keeping up the process of building the wall. But there's a bigger issue. It's not just if they don't solve this, the wall's not going to get built. The fact is, if they don't solve this, it's contrary to God's social and community law for Israel. He had made a compact with them. And unresolved, this would not only hinder the building of the wall, but it would undermine God's purpose for the restored Jerusalem. He was restoring Jerusalem for a purpose. He was restoring Jerusalem with great promises. And if this problem is not solved, it's going to undermine it. You know, there's really not much purpose in building this huge wall to protect the city when inside it's collapsing. Where the society within the walls is not functioning as it ought to by God's rules. And Nehemiah's response is both understandable and instructive. He writes in verse 6, when I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I remember reading through this chapter aloud some time ago, and when I read that sentence, I just stopped. For some reason, I just quit reading. No? When I heard their complaint, when I heard what they said and the charges they made, I got very angry. Period. Now, I know there's no punctuation in the Hebrew, but the English has a period there. So, what are we to make of this? What's going on? What did you make of it when you first read it? Hopefully you read it in preparation for either connections or your own study or whenever. You know, on Wednesday night, Rudy suggested that something to this effect. It's good to know that sometimes it's all right for Christian leaders to get angry. I have to get angry at the right things, but... And, you know, we're told in Ephesians 4:6 to be angry and sin not. So you can do the two of them together. You can be angry and not sin. Now, lots of time when you're angry, you're sinning. But you can be angry and not sin. And so maybe Rudy's correct. But maybe the next sentence. And I think this just speaks to who Nehemiah is. He's a very passionate person. He wears his emotions on his sleeve, so to speak. He is able to be very passionate about God and God's people and building the wall, but he can get very angry. But the next sentence may be even more important than that sentence. What does the next sentence say? I pondered them in my mind. You know, any time when you have to say, I will say we have to say, because sometimes I get angry. Any time you have to say, I got very angry, we need to couple it with, I took time to seriously consider the issue. If you don't take anything else away from this morning, maybe that's something some of us need to learn. He didn't just fly off the handle, oh, what are you people doing? He thought about it. Imagine that. Nehemiah tells us that he seriously considered the charges made by the people in their outcry. He did not discount their outcry. He didn't say, look, we have more important things on our plate right now. He took it seriously. And he was angry over what they said. Not because they said it, but because of what they had to say. But before acting, he took time to seriously consider the charges and what to do about them. By the way, we have no way of knowing the timeline between getting angry and acting, how long this pondering took in between. And I wonder, you know, just my curiosity, I wonder how long he pondered. And I wonder what that pondering did to his anger. Did it stoke it, or did it sort of calm it? It could do either one, you know. Anyway, I just sort of wonder about those kinds of things. What did Nehemiah, with all his passion, do in this wondering? And did he take a few seconds? I don't think that's pondering. Did he take half an hour? I don't know. Did he take overnight? Doesn't say so. I don't know how long he pondered. But he apparently, as we said previously, when that first prayer in chapter 1, at the end of this time of praying, he knew what God wanted him to do. And at the end of his pondering, he knew what to do. God directed his thinking. Isn't that valuable? You get angry, and you need to think about it, and God can show you how to handle it and what to do with it. I mean, you know, Nehemiah's God, what we've been singing about, it's the same God that we're worshiping. And now we see the activist that Wes mentioned in his message. You know, he told us it's a good thing that there's room in the church, room in God's people for the activists, even though the detailed people get a little concerned about taking off and doing something. But having considered the charges, he got angry, he thought through it, and now he says he accused the nobles and the officials of exacting usury or interest from their own countrymen. And you know what? That explains his anger. It is against the social compact of God between God and Israel to charge their own people interest. Now, usury is exorbitant interest. But within God's people, God said, any interest is exorbitant. So even though he used a different word, it's translated NIV, usury. It isn't the usual word for usury. But he makes his point. From one interest, from one Israelite to another Israelite, any loans were to be free of interest. They could charge other people reasonable interest. They were not to be making large charges against other people either. Usury was not allowed at all. But at least they could charge interest. But this is not only the basis for his anger, it's the basis for his solution. It's also the basis for his reprimand to the nobles and officials for their behavior. Look at verse 9. What you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God and avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? You know, It was a difficult time. And the people were making it more difficult. And he's saying, you are not living in the fear of God. You're God's people. But you're not paying attention to what God tells you to do. That's not new for them, and it's not new for us, unfortunately. Once again, the expositor's Bible commentary has this to say. It was in the face of the terrible misery of the Jews that Nehemiah denounced the whole practice of usury, which was the root of it. He was not contemplating those harmless commercial transactions which in our day, capital passes from one hand to another in a way of business that may be equally advantageous to the borrower and to the lender. All he saw was a state of utter ruin. Lands taken away from its old families, boys and girls being sold into slavery, and the unfortunate debtors, despite all of their sacrifices, still on the brink of starvation. In view of such a frightful condition, he naturally denounced the whole system that led to it. What else could he do? This was no time for a nice discrimination between the use and the abuse of the system. Nehemiah saw nothing but abuse. So we read, what you're doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? If you fear God, if you keep his commands, you will live in such a way that the enemies will have nothing to reproach you about. We have enemies. They're doing everything they can to stop us. Why would you give them an opening? Oh yeah, there's the people of God. They're building God's city, but they're destroying each other. Why would you give them opportunity to have hope that they can defeat us? Honor God. And he'll honor us, keeping his promises to us. Fear God. And if you fear God and live in the fear of God, if you honor his word and his teachings, then we have nothing else to fear. Nehemiah indicates in verse 10 that in the short time that he and his men had been in Jerusalem, they had already been approached by the poor asking for help. In fact, he says they had already started loaning them money and giving them grain. But he adds, but no usury, no interest. And you've got to do the same thing. You know, it's great if you're going to challenge somebody to do something. You know, we're all supposed to give tithe, and that's the training wheels of giving. And then you have to learn how to ride better and give more, 15%, 20%, whatever God calls you to do. That's a good idea if you're going to say that to somebody that you've done that. And Nehemiah is saying to the people, what you're doing is not right. You've got to stop asking interest. I and my men, my brothers and my men, so I'm not sure how much I know the one Hanani, his one brother was there, but how many of his brothers were there and how many men he had, I don't know. But he says, we've all started loaning to the people and we've all started giving them grain, but no interest. And you've got to do the same thing. Having thought about the problem and calling a meeting with all of the people who were involved, Nehemiah in verse 11 pronounces his verdict regarding the charges. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses, and also the usury you are charging them, the 100th part of the money, grain, new wine, and oil. So clearly they had been charging 1% on the money that the people owed, as well as 1% of all their produce on the lands that they had given to them as collateral, or on what they had foreclosed. So everything that they had taken from the people, anything that was produced on that land, they had to pay taxes, pay interest to them. And scholars are agreed that this 1% isn't a yearly, it's not an annual fee, it's a monthly fee, because that's the way it was done. So 12% a year, sort of compounded, but 12% a year. Not exactly free money. But that was what God had decreed for them. Nehemiah orders them, pay it back. All the interest that you had collected, pay it back. They are also give back all the lands that they had taken, either as collateral or that they had foreclosed on. And fortunately, the nobles who knew he was right, therefore they could find nothing to say in answer to the charges. You remember that chapter, that verse. They could find nothing to say. Wonder why? They knew they were wrong. Fortunately, they agreed, not just with the fact that what they did was wrong, they agreed with his solution. And they said, we will give it back. We will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say. Now that's an interesting twist because it appears that they did more than he asked. Because they not only gave back the interest, and they not only returned the lands, but they're not going to demand anything more. No more payment from them. They're saying, hey, let's make this like a jubilee year. Everybody gets their land back. Everybody's debt is cleared. Everybody starts off new and fresh. Let's do it that way. Why? Well, they knew that they had been found out, and they understood that he was right, and they needed to start doing things the way they knew they ought to be done. What a wonderful attitude. So it seems that these men who weren't doing what they knew was right now are determined to do what is right. And the big interesting thing to me is that now no one is in debt. In fact, they have the returned interest as capital to begin anew. Whatever they had paid in interest, they now had over and above having their debts cleared. Hey, prosperity for Jerusalem. Prosperity for the people of God. A new beginning to accomplish what God wants to do. Now, building on the agreement, Nehemiah in verse 12 calls the priest in and has the people who are promising to do this to take an oath before God that they're going to do it. You see, he takes no chances of people saying, yeah, well, we made a promise to the governor, but you know, no. Bring in the priest. Make it before God. You know, making the agreement with the governor may make it a community and social thing. You know, by the law, we're doing this. Bringing in God makes it a spiritual thing. And you know what? The whole problem was spiritual in the beginning. And so he's wise enough to say, let's complete the circle and bring God into this and make them make their oath before God. And he already knew, of course, the history of Israel, that people made promises they didn't keep. So he was going to just do the best he could to make sure that that didn't happen again. But Nehemiah reminds the people of the cost of not keeping their promises. He says, I also shook out the folds of my robe. And I said, in this way may God shake out of his house and possessions every man who does not keep this promise. So may such a man be shaken out and emptied. Now it sounds like this is a threat of a complete confiscation of everything that they own. But it's right in line with what God had said by his promises and his curses when he had given them the compact originally, the welfare of Israel by understanding God's social rules for Israel. Forgetting God's plan, following God's plan, let me start there. Following God's plan means prosperity for everyone. Forgetting God's plan and acting like they had been means prosperity for no one. They may have money, but it means no real prosperity for the nation. When Israel, during their history, has lived according to these rules, and they have become powerful and they have become financially strong. It has benefited the nation greatly, even though it has raised the ire and the hatred of the people who lived around about them. And anti-Semitism is still very strong. And I've listened for hours to some of my friends with many, many years ago, back in the 60s, talking about the conspiracy theory and all the things that the Jews are doing. And why? Because when they serve, when they do things the way God told them to do it, they have prospered. Hasn't always, you know, it gets in the problem sometimes, but God's rules and laws are always given for our good, for our well-being. Now, sometime later, Nehemiah, as he was writing this, had to be at least 12 years later. Not this part, the part that's coming. At this, the whole assembly said, "Amen," and praised the Lord. And the people did as they had promised. Can you see Nehemiah sitting there, either dictating this to his scribe or writing it out, and a big smile on his face when he says, "And the people did what they promised." Wow, that was a victory. That was a good thing to happen at that point in time. You know? The problem had been identified, judiciously handled, resolved, and brought to a successful conclusion. Anger was channeled by serious consideration, and management of the problem was taken and successful. Now, it's here that Nehemiah sort of adds a footnote or an endnote. It's got to be at least 12 years later. It may be longer or later than that. But he talks about what he had done for the first 12 years of his service as governor. I think this is the first place in the text that we learn that he not only was sent back to build the wall, but that he was given the title of governor and all the authority that goes with it. But he says he did not take any of the food from the people of Jerusalem. That was, they were supposed to provide for their governor. And that out of reverence for God, he did not act like the previous governors. Instead, he devoted himself to the work on the wall, and he and his men who were assembled there for the work, not the perks of the office. And one proof was that neither he nor his men acquired any land. Instead of taking food, he provided food for many people. Now, one of these statements, which I've just made, sort of resonates for me in a different way than it probably would for you. They didn't purchase any land. They didn't acquire any land. You know, I worked among the Balaan social minority group, tribal group in the Philippines. And we had some lowlanders, main people of the Philippines, come and pastor some of the Balaan churches. And after a while, for some reason or other, the Balaan didn't want to have the lowlanders come and pastor their church. And the reason was that in difficult times, when people needed money, it seemed like the lowlander pastors could always go to their families and get enough money to buy the land and the farms of the Balaan. So they came to pastor the church, but they ended up with the farms of the Balaan members. So none of the churches wanted the lowlanders for pastors. It became an irritant that hindered the work. It wasn't intentionally done. They were taking fair opportunity that was given to them. But not everything that seems like good business is necessarily the right thing for the expansion of the church. But he says, none of his men, nor his brothers, they did not acquire any land. And so I see, you know, Nehemiah had a huge impact on his people, the people who worked for him, on their lives and the mores of the men who were under him. Now, part of the reason for Nehemiah's faithfulness to God in this task is his confidence in the faithfulness of the God of Israel, the God of heaven. He wasn't after personal financial gain. He lived for eternal and spiritual gain by serving God well. That was his purpose. He asked God to view him in favor in light of all that he had done for the people of Jerusalem. Building the wall, solving their social problems, bringing in a new day of prosperity for the city. Look at what I've done. What is he saying? He's just saying, I'm not in it. I'm not in it to get wealthy, although he lived very comfortably as the governor. But I'm in it for spiritual gain. I'm in it for spiritual favor, for eternal favor. Nehemiah seems to have faced every obstacle, and there were many obstacles, as you heard and as you're going to continue to hear, with confidence in the faithfulness of God. And that confidence in the faithfulness of God prompted his faithfulness in return to God. And if you really believe that God is faithful, it will impact how you serve him. Yeah. When God instructed him as to what he was to do, Nehemiah did it. What a great example to follow. You know, one of the things that I've thought about as I've looked at this portion, you see what, not everything that is legal is right. And you think of the ridicule that some debtor nation to Greece would face if they said, yeah, you owe us 50 million euros. But every time you make a payment on time, we will not take any interest. If you fail you don't reach the date, then we're going to charge you interest. But you're not going to be charged interest on this if you do it on time. There'd be a lot of other nations rather upset with them, you know. If Canada said, yeah, we're going to give you so much money, but we'll only charge you half of them. You know, we'll give you 50, but you only owe us 25, whatever, you know. Euros, dollars, whatever. Are you guys crazy? What's going on? But you know, that's the kind of thing that God wanted Israel to do for each other. And I think we can learn from this. What we need to do when people are having a hard time is not stick your foot on their neck and rub them into the ground. It's to lift them up. And particularly with God's people. And I know this happens. I know that within our congregation, there have been people who have put money, don't put checks because then that sort of identifies who's doing it, but put money in an envelope and just stick it in somebody's slot in the mail back there because they know that they're going through a difficult time. And I just think this sort of follows off of what God is wanting people to do and how God wants us to live. Not just going after the letter of the law, but doing more than that. And living like he would have us to live. Trusting him in his faithfulness, that he'll be faithful to us so that we can be faithful to him. May God grant that we do that. We need to be faithful on that basis. You're never going to outdo God. And when God calls you, and I don't know what he's calling you to, okay, this morning, what he wants you to do, but as he spoke to Nehemiah and made things clear, and Nehemiah never tells us how that happened, it's just that he prayed and he fasted and he wept. You know, Ezra did the same thing. You read in Ezra that when the people were marrying people outside Israel, he got very upset and he cried, he wept, he fasted, he prayed. But he didn't confront the people and try to change it, you know. Ezra and Nehemiah were both very godly people, and God used them greatly. And not all of us are like Nehemiah. Some of us are more like Ezra. But there's room in the church of people of God for all kinds of characters who will faithfully serve God because God is faithful. So I don't know what God's calling you to do. He's probably calling you to do something different than he's calling me to do. But we just need to understand what he's calling us to do. And be faithful, whether it makes sense financially or not, whether it makes sense socially or not, why it makes sense in the eyes of your friends or your critics, that doesn't really matter. We make it matter, but it doesn't really matter. But allow God to lead you and just be faithful in what he's calling you to do. You don't have to do what I'm doing, right? You don't have to do what Neil's doing or Ralph or anybody else, You just have to do what God's calling you to do. And be faithful in doing that. And God has in store great blessings for us, for you, and for all of us that are connected to you, if we are faithful in doing what he wants us to do. I believe he has great things in store for us. But he requires, he asks, he pleads, do things my way and do what I ask you to do. May God grant us to do this. Father, I pray for this people, my people. I love them. You love them greater than anybody here could love. And I pray that as they go from here, they would say, like Nehemiah, in face of external difficulties and internal difficulties, I'm going to find out what God wants me to do, and I'm going to do it. Give us grace. All of your commands to us are for our good, for our well-being. And we ask you for your grace in enabling us to be the people you want us to be. In Jesus' name, amen.